On August 13, 2022, Dr. Michael Sala presented his findings on world religions and extraterrestrial contact, revealing our suppressed history, the origins of Atlantis, Lemuria, and the return of the creator gods. As part of Exopolitics Today's ongoing efforts and contributions to humanity's awakening, we present to you in two parts this webinar for your consideration.
We really are in exciting times. This is a time when many have prophesied and talked about this, and we're living it right now. If the world appears chaotic, unpredictable, lots of uncertainty, what we can say for sure is that religions have talked about this period. Many great prophets have talked about this time when our world would be at a turning point. Many of us come from a scientific background, a social scientific background. That's my background, is in the social sciences. And religion has always been kept separate. In fact, I actually did a year of theology. I actually went to a seminary for 1 year back in 1983. And I just didn't cut it. And so I decided that I would do a conventional social science training. And what was clear to me was that, there was a really big separation between religion and science. And of course, we know that separation is something that stems out of the era of the Enlightenment, when there was this separation of church and state, because the church up until the era of the Enlightenment around the 1700s, the church reigned supreme. And of course, people who said things that went against the church dogma, or who today would be labeled conspiracy theorists, back in the day, they were deemed to be heretics. And there were severe penalties for being a heretic. And so, of course, because of that experience, with the Age of Enlightenment, when rationalists got the power through national legislatures, they separated church and state. And of course, in the United States, and as in major European countries, we have this very clear separation. But that separation is only very, very recent. Throughout recorded history, and even that period before recorded history, which was the oral history of humanity, there was no differentiation between church and state. Science and magic and the occult were all one, and religion, they were all one. They were integrated. And I think we're living in an era when this separation between church and state, that is about to be surely tested by what is about to unravel. Because I think we are going to witness something phenomenal. And that's what I'll be talking about today, which is the return of the gods. But it's not going to be gods as in these mythical spiritual creatures that are described in mythologies around the world. These are going to be beings that arrive in a number of different ways. One of those, of course, is through advanced technology, spacecraft, and others through portals, interdimensional doorways. And this is going to lead to a unification of science and religion. So today, I'm going to be talking about the history of world religions and extraterrestrial contact, how the two have been intertwined from the beginning. And it's only, as I said, just in our recent history that there's a separation between church and state, religion and science. Where do we begin? If we want to understand what are world religions, how are they related to extraterrestrial contact, we've got to begin by going to these creation myths. So let me go over to my first slide. Creation myths. These are myths based on the idea of a primordial void or the primordial waters or even a primordial chaos. Now, this is something you find in virtually all the religious traditions, indigenous traditions as well. There is this great void at the beginning of time, or the great waters. And out of these waters, out of this void, the first gods suddenly emerge, fully empowered, and they are described as gods. And these are beings that have great power, and they, at the inception of this kind of primordial history, they are the only ones around, these primordial gods. So these gods just kind of come out of the primordial waters or the void, and they are described in all these religious traditions as the creator gods. And of course, recently we've got the ancient astronaut theorists or ancient aliens series that describes these extraterrestrials or these creator gods as ancient aliens. But, you know, we really need to differentiate between the first creator gods, the ones that came out of the primordial waters and then bore offspring, and they created successor gods. And as that process developed, you had more and more successor gods being created. So what does all of this refer to? These ancient historical texts, what process are they describing? I think what they are describing is the arrival of non-terrestrial visitors, I'm talking about extraterrestrial visitors, from outer space, portals, or out of the Earth's oceans. And they possess advanced technologies, and these were interpreted by indigenous peoples, primitive humans, as gods arriving from the primordial void or the waters. So whether we're talking about extraterrestrials arriving on Earth through spacecraft or arriving on Earth through space-time portals or emerging out of the oceans with their advanced technologies, the first peoples, the first surface dwellers, would have regarded these extraterrestrials as gods. And they would have given due deference to them because, of course, these first extraterrestrials, these creator gods, as they appeared to the first humans, the hominids, possessed advanced technologies. And it was Arthur C. Clarke that said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So for the first peoples, the advanced technologies that these beings exhibited would have been considered magic, very highly above magic. And so they would have been considered great gods or magicians. So that's, I think, what these historical texts are referring to, this process whereby the first creator gods that emerged out of the void, out of the waters, were these extraterrestrials with advanced technologies that appeared before primitive humans, and the technological disparity, the knowledge gap between these two groups was so great that the primitives regarded these extraterrestrials as gods, and creator gods was a name also given to them in terms of their place in the genealogy of the gods. So the very first, the oldest recorded creation story is the Enuma Elish. And in this creation story, in the Enuma Elish, it describes the creation of the gods, or these are creator gods who fought against their creators. So the first creator gods that emerged out of the waters in the Sumerian records, in the Enuma Elish, were Apsu and Tiamat. Now, Tiamat was also described as the great goddess of the waters. So there's a little bit of kind of confusion as to whether she embodied the waters, the primordial waters, or whether she was the consort of Apsu in this period when the first gods emerged. But Apsu and Tiamat are the first creator gods. They emerge out of the primordial waters, and then they go on to create a series of gods that ultimately created humanity as a slave race. So this, the Enuma Elish was first transmitted orally from generation to generation, from Sumeria, and then eventually it went through Akkadia, the Babylonians, and it was recorded in text in Babylonian around 1900 BC. And even though the original was from Sumer, though that is the original creation story. The first creation story comes from Sumer. So it had a number of tablets. So I want to spend a little bit of time describing these first, the tablets, the Sumerian records of the Enuma Elish as they've been recorded, because these give us the basic outline of a pattern that repeats itself again and again in other great traditions. So the very first tablet in the Enuma Elish, this is what it says: before the heavens had been named, before the earth below had been named, none but Apsu, the All-Father, oldest of beings, and Mumu Tiamat, mother who bore them, existed. The gods were then created within the waters of Apsu Tiamat. So there you have the reference to the waters and Apsu and Tiamat being the first gods that emerged out of the waters, and then they, through their creative ability, create offspring. So this is the pattern that emerges in other religious traditions. So the Enuma Elish describes this. So the gods that are birthed by the Apsu and Tiamat, eventually they begin to quarrel amongst one another. And so there's a war against Apsu, the first primordial god, the All-Father, if you like. So Tiamat, their mother, became troubled by her children, the gods. Her still depths became agitated. So there's the reference to Tiamat representing the primordial waters. You know, whether we're talking about the great oceans out of which the first aquatic life emerged, intelligent aquatic life, or some other primordial waters, it's not quite clear. But I think when we think about the emergence of intelligent life on Earth, we can't discount the idea that intelligent life didn't so much come out from the stars, but may have emerged fully formed out of the waters, out of the great oceans. So I'll explain a little bit more about that shortly. So the gods are created by Apsu and Tiamat, and so there's a lot of turmoil. Apsu, the first All-Father, could not calm the gods. Tiamat became angry. So then the gods go to war against Apsu. So Apsu is now the bad guy because he, even though he's the All-Father that created the gods, the gods that were created by him are very upset for one reason or another, and so then war emerged. Then did war rage between Ea, Enki. Now, very interesting, I just learned this, that Enki actually, in Sumerian, means custodian or master of earth. En means custodian or master. Ki is the Sumerian for earth. Now, Enki is a title for the master or custodian of earth. And the very first custodian was Ea, one of the creator gods, Ea, that's how I will pronounce it. So Ea is actually Enki. So Enki is a title, but Ea is Enki as we understand him today. So Enki is the defender of the gods, and his father is Apsu. And the brother of Apsu is Mumu. And so there's a war that does rage between them. So the second tablet describes Tiamat finished the monsters. she had been creating to set upon her children, the gods. She did this evil deed to avenge the murder of Apsu. So Apsu is killed in this war between the creator gods. So Apsu is killed. Tiamat is now upset. And so she unleashes her hordes, her primordial hordes, monsters, whatever beings that she's in control of, to avenge the murder of her consort, Apsu. So you can see the big dragon there, the kind of representation of those draconian energies. So Tiamat goes to war against the gods led by Enki and the others that work with him that defeated and supplanted Apsu. So the second tablet continues. Nowhere is there a god who can defeat Tiamat. Tiamat will destroy all who try. Lord Ansha, speaking forcefully, said, "He whose strength is mighty shall be our avenger, the great warrior Marduk, the hero." So apparently, of all of the gods, the only one that has the power to defeat Tiamat is Marduk, the son of Enki. So Marduk also, you can see he's also got these dragon energies associated with him. So there is this great battle between one group of gods led by Tiamat and another group of gods led by Marduk. And interestingly, Marduk is given authority by an assembly. So the gods have an assembly and somehow they have to give Marduk some authority. They have to acquiesce to Marduk being allowed to use certain powers, which it will enable him to then slay Tiamat. So the tablet goes on. He told of Anu's failure. So apparently Anu is the father of Enki and the father of Enlil, who we'll talk about soon. And Enki, of course, is the father of Marduk. So Anu is one of the creator gods. He tried to appease Tiamat with diplomacy and he failed. And so now it's up to Marduk using warfare to defeat Tiamat. And the new hero, Marduk, who needed the supreme power which only the assembly of the gods could give him in order that he might slay Tiamat. So that's a typo down there. So that's he might slay Tiamat. So, but the interesting thing here in this tablet is that Marduk needed the supreme power which only the assembly of the gods could give him. So right here you have a recurring theme in the literature, in the ancient literatures concerning the gods, is that there is an assembly, and it's this assembly which confers power on any one god to be able to do anything. So there's no one all-powerful god here. It's really just a succession of creator gods who vie against each other, and they have an assembly where they can meet and they can discuss and come up with plans and solutions and authorize one of them to take the lead in one area or another. And that's a pattern that repeats again and again. So Marduk is given authority by the assembly of gods. So, and the tablet goes on. All these great gods who controlled destinies came before Ansha. They entered the assembly hall named Ubushinkina. So that's a representation of the assembly. So that's the important point that I want to emphasize here, because later on we'll be talking a lot about these different assemblies and what that means today. So the primordial waters, what I think that refers to is that there was a war between ocean and surface-dwelling civilizations, that this kind of history of different creator gods coming along and establishing a presence and establishing assemblies and having offspring, eventually they establish dwellings or habitats on the earth. And I think one of these wars, probably the first one, the war against Tiamat and Apsu, represented the first, this war of the gods between ocean dwellers and surface dwellers, that Tiamat and Apsu represented the ocean-dwelling gods, and that Anu, Enlil, and Enki represented the surface-dwelling gods. And so that was the war that happened. So is there any kind of insight into this kind of battle between intelligent life on Earth having wars in terms of ocean dwellers and surface dwellers? Well, there is. Actually, very recently, I interviewed someone called Sumbo Truebrother, and he's the author of The Sasquatch Message to Humanity. Fascinating book, and I talked about that in the interview as to how much really important information is in there for understanding our true history. Now, he talked about a succession of extraterrestrial hybrid civilizations, and he pointed out that the first civilization was the fish people, so the aquatics. They were the first intelligent civilization. And so you can imagine if you have these different gods representing these genetic experiments involving indigenous life, you know, some were aquatics, fish people, some were insectoids, some were reptilians, the bird people, the Sasquatch, and humans, finally, that each of these represented genetic experiments where these initial creator gods tinkered with the DNA of different species on Earth or in other planets to create these hybrids, whether they were aquatics, whether they were insectoids, reptilians, and so forth. And there were wars between these different beings. And in the Sasquatch Message to Humanity, he describes these different wars, how these different hybrid civilizations didn't get on with one another, and how, as a consequence, the next genetic experiment was permitted. So what I think was happening is that as you have these different genetic experiments occurring and there are disputes and there's fighting and wars, then as a solution, the assembly of gods gives approval to the creation of a new genetic experiment. So there are new hybrids created, and so on it goes. And so there's a list of the different beings that have been created. Now, one of the updates that I'm going to be giving very shortly from JP, my US Army insider, who's been on a number of classified missions to Ganymede, to the moon, to an ark buried in the Atlantic Ocean, is that he had a recent mission to an underwater city in the Bermuda Triangle, and described this underwater city as being something in a huge dome, very large, miles wide, and he described it as populated by these very tall human-looking beings with very advanced technologies, spacecraft, and that they were able to pick him up and a number of other covert operatives from a military base and took them to this underwater city. And he says he was providing escort duties for someone in a suit with a tie and so forth, who was there to do the negotiations with these fish people, if you like, or this Aquarian civilization. And so he describes seeing three huge domes, and in each of these domes there was a city, and these were connected. And he described it as being somewhere in the Bermuda Triangle region. So one of the things he pointed out in the briefing is that the aquatics were making agreements or reaching or doing negotiating with US government representatives or the covert military representatives in terms of sharing technology. Now, hopefully that'll lead to some future disclosure. But what it shows is that one of the things we have not really understood well is the existence of these aquatic civilizations who live in these vast cities at the bottom of the ocean. And apparently there are many of these cities, and they go back a long, long time, tens of thousands of, even hundreds of thousands of years, and that they've been there watching us on the surface. And occasionally there have been wars between surface dwellers and these aquatic civilizations. So returning to the Enuma Elish, now we go to the fifth tablet in that. It tells us more about what subsequently happened. So after the war against Tiamat and Apsu, the ocean dwellers, the ocean-oriented gods, Marduk, Enlil, and Enki, the victorious surface-dwelling gods, they then were very prominent in this reorganization of the universe. So Marduk, he's the victorious hero. He slays Tiamat. And so he plays a key role in organizing the universe and gives the gods their station. So Marduk is the warrior god, but he gives leadership positions to his uncle and father in terms of this reorganization. So Marduk instructed each god in turn in terms of their place in the universe. So this is the new Anunnaki world order as it's described in the Enuma Elish and subsequent Sumerian texts. Anu, the father god, the new all-father. Enlil, and of course, when I say the new all-father, I mean he supplanted Apsu, who was the first all-father. And so now you have Anu, then you have Enlil, Enki, and Ninhursag, who is the consort of Enki. Then you have surface-dwelling gods, led by the warrior general Marduk. And they, of course, defeated the ocean-dwelling gods led by Tiamat and Apsu. So the six tablets, this is where we get into the creation of man. So all the tablets up until this time just describe a succession of gods being created and fighting against each other, creating an assembly and sorting out a kind of Anunnaki world order. And so now this world order has been created. Anu, Enlil, Enki, and Ninhursag are the four gods now that are at the apex of this Anunnaki world order. So the sixth tablet deals with the creation of man. So the creation of man kind of like comes pretty far down the list in terms of what it was that the Anunnaki had done. So I will create a creature named man. He will do all the work of the gods so that the gods may be free. So what that's referring to is for each iteration of gods that were created by the creator gods, you eventually have a kind of subordinate class of gods who have advanced technology and are servants of the superior gods. But these servant gods that are called the Ijiji in the Sumerian texts rebel. They don't want to continue to be slaves to Enlil and the other supreme gods. So they rebel. So Enlil, or more precisely, the assembly, the Anunnaki assembly, which Anu and Enlil are in charge of, give authority to Enki to create a worker race, because Enki is the master geneticist. He is the one that understands genetics. And so he's given this authority. So the sixth tablet describes the creation of man. And it describes how they bound Kingu, who is was the warrior general of Tiamat in the first primordial war. Well, actually the second, because the first was to supplant Apsu. The second was Marduk fighting against Enki. So Kingu was fighting on behalf of Tiamat. And so now he is brought in chains before Ea or Enki. His throat was cut, and from his blood, man was created in order to serve the gods. Now, what's very interesting here is that Kingu was brought before Ea, Enki, because Enki is the master geneticist. And from his blood, man was created. So Enki looked at the DNA of Kingu and created humanity. And the role of humanity here was to serve the gods. Now, what's very interesting, and later on I'll be talking about this, and I want to mention a shout-out to Elena Danan. She's working on her new book, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But I wanted to just mention that in her book, she comes up, she describes an encounter with Enki. And one of the things that Enki said in his conversation with Elena, which is very relevant to this point here in terms of Enki using the blood of Kingu, one of the older creator gods, to create humans, was that Enki, when he was creating man and creating a slave race, he and the other Anunnaki didn't know that the DNA of the primates on Earth actually was in itself an offshoot of earlier genetic experiments of other extraterrestrial races, because the Anunnaki, they came along and they used the early human, the early primates, and genetically upgraded them, thinking that, well, you know, they're starting tabula rasa, these are just primates, and we will genetically upgrade them, and that way they will be suitable slaves. But what Enki and the Anu and the other Anunnaki didn't understand was that the human primates on Earth had already been genetically upgraded by previous extraterrestrial civilization, by previous guardians, was cedar races, that the Anunnaki didn't know that. So when Enki began to genetically alter these primates, he was shocked to find that the primates, when their DNA was altered with the addition of Anunnaki DNA, these humans had incredible potential, far greater than what the Anunnaki had dreamed of. So there's another text, which is the Akkadian version of the creation story and the Great Flood. So the Eridu Genesis is the Sumerian record of the Great Flood. And it doesn't exist in whole. There's only fragments of it. But most of the Anunnaki or the Sumerian version of the Great Flood is recorded in the Akkadian version. And it's called the Atrahasis. And the Atrahasis also refers to the hero. So Atrahasis is both a text describing the Great Flood in the Akkadian version and also describes the hero, who is also described as Utnapishtim, the survivor of the Great Flood, or Noah. So Atrahasis is the same as Utnapishtim or Noah. And we'll talk about Noah a little bit later. So the Atrahasis, that describes conditions immediately after the creation. And it describes this process that I've just described. The lower gods have to work very hard and start to complain. So there's the revolt, negotiations with the great gods. And again, I just want to really emphasize this, because it's never been a matter of just one supreme or powerful god saying this is the way it is. It's always been an assembly of the gods where they work things out. There's negotiations and they come up with a plan of action for how to deal with any situation, any exigency that confronts the gods or their creation, the humans. So there's a proposal to create humans to relieve the lower gods from their labor. So Atrahasis and the creation of man, Eden was a genetic experiment. So this is obviously representing this genetic experiment where you actually have the first man and the creation of a woman, a female. So that we can take that as a representation of Enki. I don't think he kind of looks like that, but nevertheless, that's the representation that we can say that that's Enki, and say, okay, just say assume that's Adam or an early version of Adam, and so we can see Eve being created. So they've been created according to the Enuma Elish out of the blood of Kingu, And Kingu represents the DNA of the older gods. These early humans have this incredible potential that Enki discovers. And Eden, where is Eden? Now, the assumption that we all make was that Eden was a territory on Earth where this genetic experiment was conducted. But it may actually be that this genetic experiment was conducted on one of the spacecraft, that Enki's spacecraft, that Enki was on a spacecraft called Nibiru. That Nibiru, rather than being a planet, was actually a spacecraft. And Enki's laboratory on Nibiru was described as an Eden. This, and I'm just kind of like referring to the information Elena got from Enki in her encounter that I'll go into detail in later on. So that tells us that the first, well, one of the Edens was on this spacecraft, Nibiru. Of course, others describe Eden as being on the Earth, and that's possible too, because there have been a number of genetic experiments, not just one. This is just one of many. So the Atrahasis describes conditions leading up to the Great Flood, man's noisy behavior, new complaints from the gods, lack of fidelity, humans weren't very loyal, war, etc. So the chief god Enlil's decision to extinguish mankind by a great flood. So the Anunnaki disagree over humanity's future. So this is where Enki and Enlil have a dispute. Enki wants to protect his experiment, whereas Enlil wants to wipe it all out and start from scratch. Kill all the humans on Earth and start from scratch. Start with a new primate and genetically alter that so that it can become a suitable slave worker, whereas Enki wants to save humanity and works to inform a certain number of individuals. And of course, we know about Atrahasis or Utnapishtim or Noah being warned about the coming flood, getting in an ark and so forth. So what does all that mean? I'll talk about that shortly. So Atrahasis, the book describes the conditions up to the Great Flood. So Atrahasis, the person, is warned in a dream. So Enki warns him in a dream. Enki explains the dream to Atrahasis and betrays the plan. There's going to be a Great Flood and you need to leave the planet. So it describes the creation of an ark. So Enki is the protector of humanity in the upcoming Great Flood. So here's a quote about this period and the role Enki played. The Sumerian god Enki, later known as Ea in Akkadian and Babylonian mythology, went against the decision of the rest of the gods and ordered Utnapishtim, Atrahasis, to abandon his worldly possession and create a huge ship to be called the Preserver of Life. So even though some of the gods wanted to go along with this idea of just allowing humanity to be wiped out in a great flood, Enki and whoever other gods supported him wanted to preserve some of the humans through these huge ships or these arcs, the Preserver of Life. Now, in an earlier webinar, I described the ark, and there wasn't just one ark. There were many arcs because it's never been that humanity was the byproduct of one extraterrestrial civilization. There have been as many as 24 extraterrestrial civilizations that have genetically upgraded humanity, mixed their DNA. So when a new group of extraterrestrials visit Earth and see the hominids, the primitive indigenous peoples, and they make the assumption, well, these are just kind of like indigenous to the Earth, they've evolved through natural selection and so forth. But no, in fact, that they are genetic offspring of earlier extraterrestrial interventions. And so there have been a number of arcs, a number of floods, and a number of times that this kind of like the genetic experiment has been reset. So There have been 270 flood stories worldwide that refer to these arks rescuing righteous humans from the wrath of the gods. So I described that in that webinar, E.T. Cedars, Space Arks, and the Great Reveal. So the legendary arks are described in multiple religious traditions and historical texts. And in fact, rather than being just wooden constructs built very hastily by indigenous persons being guided by one of the gods or by an extraterrestrial, these are actually referring to spacecraft that come and pick them up. And in that earlier webinar, I played a video clip from Dolores Cannon, where she described how these arcs would appear at the end of an era, at one of these times when there would be a worldwide flood and there would all, or some kind of cataclysm, and the surface population would have to be evacuated. So I played that, but I thought it would be good to play it again for those of you who haven't heard it, because I think it's very revealing in terms of how these arcs suddenly appear. Because as I said, it's not just one arc involved with one genetic experiment run by one extraterrestrial species. There are 24 cedar races that have been involved in genetically altering humanity over many hundreds of thousands of years. And so they appear at the end of an age with these arcs to rescue their genetic byproducts. So I'll play that video now. You'll hear the audio.
I see ships, alien ships. They're coming down. They create fear, but they're not hostile.
He described the ships as
sort of round, but not ball-shaped, more oval. They're not little two or three man things. They're bigger. They can hold many people.
The ships were not landing, but hovering over the ground.
And all the people from many villages are here.
What happens?
We have to leave. Everybody has to go in the ship.
Why would you have to leave? This is your home.
Because something's going to happen. And if we don't leave, we'll be killed. Me and this woman and other people from other villages are going to help lead them on these ships. We're trying to round them up. Some go willingly. They're willing to follow. And others, you have to encourage them. They think it's crazy.
I asked for a description of the inside of the ship after everyone was on board.
It is good size. There's room for everybody, and it's not crowded.
You said there are several ships?
Yes, in different places. You can look in the distance and see them. You can take stuff with you if you want, or animals, and whatever you think.
Can you see the people that have come with the ship? What do they look like?
They're trying to look non-threatening. They're trying to smile and hold out their hand and be friendly. Be careful of who they approach.
Do they look human?
Yes.
Just ask them what's going on down there.
Just planetary changes that you wouldn't understand. It's kind of a cross between a volcano and a comet and a nuclear explosion. That's the closest he can describe that I can understand. They knew it was coming, and that's why they wanted to take as many people off as they could. And we'll go back.
Will you go back right away?
He starts to explain that we can be held in a situation where time goes by, but we don't change. And then we'll just go back.
That's an interesting way to put it. Time will go by, but you won't change. Can he explain it any better?
It's not suspended animation. Time will go by, but you won't... How do I explain it? Time goes by on Earth. Time does not go by on the ship. The Earth will go through stuff, and the ship won't.
Are they going to keep you on the ship until it's time to go back?
Right. It's not going to be very long.
But on Earth, it would be much longer.
Yes.
So you won't go anywhere else? You just stay on the ship?
Just hover.
That answered the question I had earlier. I thought they would have to be taken somewhere where they could wait out a catastrophe and not be able to return until the Earth was capable of supporting life again, which could be thousands of years. If they were not trapped by the concept of time, it would be rather like watching the events like a fast forward on a videotape.
That is good that it will not take that long, because the people won't get that upset. There is plenty of room, so some of them brought their animals with them. It's like a Noah's Ark.
That's what I was thinking. It sounded like it.
We won't feel like it's a long time on the ship.
What's described in that audio clip was these arts suddenly appear all over the Earth. People are warned about a coming cataclysm. They are encouraged to enter the arcs. They're taken into the arcs. Then the arcs go off planet for a short period of time relative to the humans that are in these arcs. But in fact, on Earth, there's been a much longer period that's elapsed. So it's because these are space-time vehicles. So that's what that clip describes. So I'll go on. So the Sumerian source texts are clear. Enki is humanity's protector. And I want to just kind of emphasize that, because recently there has been a campaign, or there are a number of people that have been coming forward saying, well, Enki is the evil one and Enlil was the good god. And that's actually contrary to everything we know from the Sumerian texts, because Enki was the geneticist. Enki was the one that created humans. Enki was the one that protected the humans. Enki had a vested interest, whereas Enlil was this, his name just meant that he was the god of thunder or the god of power, and he was someone that was interested in rule, and humans were a threat to his power because humans had this incredible potential. So that's very important, that anyone coming forward saying Enki was the bad guy, right there they're going against what the historical texts tell us, and so there's an agenda there. So I'm going to switch over. So the Enuma Elish and the Bible. So there have been a number of biblical researchers, theologians, who have looked at the Enuma Elish and the Holy Bible and noted the similarities in the stories. And so this is one quote. Enuma Elish and the Holy Bible are very similar to each other. In fact, leading researchers across the globe are of the opinion that the New Testament was written on the basis of the Enuma Elish. While not all the text is similar, there are instances wherein the Holy Bible has contents, especially pertaining to the creation of the universe, which clearly showcase its similarity to the Enuma Elish. Now, why the similarity between those? Well, I think it's very important to point out that Abraham, the father of the Hebrew nation, was actually from Sumer. He was a Sumerian, or an Akkadian in terms of the civilization in which existed at the time, because Akkadia had supplanted Sumer. But nevertheless, Ur, which was the city that Abraham came from, was established by the Sumerians. And the Sumerian culture was very respected by the Akkadians. So in a very similar way to how the Romans respected the ancient Greek culture. So just as the Romans imported the Greek gods, you have the Greek gods being Romanized or put into given names in the Roman tradition. So Ares, the god of war, becomes Mars in the Roman. Hera becomes Jupiter, Juno, and so forth. The Sumerians and the Akkadians had that kind of similar relationship. So Abraham, the father of the Hebrew nation, he took with him a lot of these Sumerian legends. And this is where the key texts of the Bible were created. They were based on that, because early on, we're talking about oral records of the Great Flood, of the creation, and these were just reframed in terms of this new culture in which Abraham lived. So as the Akkadians would want to rename the gods from the Sumer in terms of their kind of in terms of their great heroes or their iconic figures. Similarly, the Hebrews did the same with the Sumerian texts. So Noah's Ark was based on the Sumerian flood story. So this is where we get the Epic of Gilgamesh or the Atrahasis that both describe the great flood. The Book of Enoch, this incorporates a lot of the same elements from the Sumerian legends about events leading up to the Great Flood. And it discusses the spread of advanced technologies by the fallen angels, which we can consider gods or extraterrestrials, and how these are corrupted humanity, which needed to be cleansed. So the Book of Enoch dates from this pre-flood civilization, and it describes the conditions leading up to the great flood. And in the Book of Enoch, it describes Enoch being taken up into the heavens where he meets the different angelic orders, the different angels and angelic orders, and he gets to mediate between different conflicting angels, the fallen angels and so forth. Well, what that is describing in reality was that Enoch was an extraterrestrial contactee. He was taken up into spacecraft, taken to the headquarters of these different governing councils that regulated the conflicts between the extraterrestrials, and he would speak on behalf of humanity and kind of like be a witness to what was really going on. So that was what Enoch did, and that's what you can read in the Book of Enoch. And the Book of Enoch describes how these advanced technologies were spread in a way that led to the corruption of humans, that humanity was corrupted because somehow we weren't ready at that time for these very advanced technologies, and that the fallen angels knew this and that they were therefore responsible. And so they were brought to account in these different councils. So that's the Book of Enoch. So it describes these ET assemblies. So you have the wars between the corrupt and the righteous humans and angels, described as space battles. And these space battles involved advanced technologies. Enoch mediated between the different angelic orders, and he visited these different assemblies, Confederation of Planets, the Council of Saturn, the Galactic Federation, names that we've all heard of more recently, but these are very likely the very same or similar organization that Enoch was taken to and was a witness for events on Earth, because these assemblies, these extraterrestrial assemblies, in adjudicating between the different conflicts between the various extraterrestrial factions, wanted a neutral, impartial witness. So that's the role Enoch played. And so that's what happened. And so it shows, again, that it's not just one or powerful deity making these decrees. There are these assemblies where they need to hear both sides, interested parties, and then they adjudicate. So Enoch learned of the Law of One from the Confederation of Planets. So this is a very important point now, because so far what I've been talking about is these are gods that emerged out of the primordial waters or out of the primordial void, where they establish assemblies and they vie for the position of the supreme god, and there's a hierarchy, but there are these assemblies where power is differentiated in a very nuanced, subtle way in terms of hierarchy. So Enoch learned about the Law of One because Enoch was a pre-flood figure. And the Law of One, well, what is it? The Law of One books, for those that don't know, that's a series of books that were channeled by Carla Rueckert and Don Elkins from 1981 to 1984, and they've stood the test of time in terms of being very accurate. And so this is what was said about the Law of One. Quote, "We are old upon your planet and have served with the varying degrees of success in transmitting the Law of One, of unity, of singleness to your peoples. We have walked your earth. We have seen the faces of your peoples. This is not so with many of the entities of the Confederation. We found it was not efficacious. However, we then felt the great responsibility of staying in the capacity of removing the distortions of powers that had been given to the Law of One." End quote. So this is describing one of the groups associated with this confederation of planets that many thousands of years ago, prior to the Great Flood, began to interact with humanity. They could be considered one of the councils, one of the groups that had a vested interest in the genetic experiments on Earth, but they wanted to spread this philosophy called the Law of One. And so what is the Law of One? The Confederation of Planets and the Law of One, the Confederation scientists conclude that humanity's worship of gods, extraterrestrials, retards human development and thereby promote the Law of One philosophy in the different regions. These are the ET genetic experiments. So the Confederation of Planets, they, being one of these assemblies, look at all of the genetic experiments on Earth. They look at these succession of gods that come in and establish dominance, and they look at that and say, well, humans aren't evolving very much from this. They, for whatever reason, they become dependent on the gods in terms of thinking and free will choices. In order to change this, we need to encourage a philosophy where the humans will become independent of the gods and begin to rely on their own free will decisions. So this is the background to the Law of One philosophy. So the Law of One is defined. So in session 4 from the Law of One teachings, it says, "I am Ra, the Law of One, though beyond the limitations of name, as you call vibratory sound complexes, may be approximated by stating that all things are one, that there is no polarity, no right or wrong, no disharmony, but only identity. All is one, and that one is love light, the infinite creator." So that's very interesting, because the Law of One is introducing a very different way of understanding creation and humanity's role in creation, rather than humanity understanding itself in virtue of its connection to these gods who were their creators, and thereby humanity owes fealty or loyalty to these creator gods. The Law of One is saying that there is this one infinite creator, this referring to the primordial waters or the void as being this infinite creator, that it's not the successor or the creator gods that emerged out of the infinite creator, that the infinite creator, the waters, the primordial waters, or the void, is this formless, infinite creation that just emanates love light. And that out of that, these creator gods that emerge, they are kind of like, in a way, intermediaries to this one infinite creator. So this is where the Law of One is associated with the birth of monotheism. Because monotheism is something that can be very easily distorted in terms of these creator gods. So the Law of One is a monotheistic belief system that has been historically hijacked by one of the gods, or the Elohim, claiming to be the one supreme creator god to be worshipped exclusively. So you have the gods, or in the biblical traditions, they're described as the Elohim, who claim to be the supreme creator god, and that they are to be worshipped exclusively. And that is a a kind of distortion of this law of one philosophy, which teaches that all is one, and that one is love, light, light, love, the one infinite creator, that it's not a particular deity. It's not personified in a particular deity. It's the all that is important, and that the distinguishing characteristic of that one infinite creator associated with the primordial waters, the creative potential that gave birth to the gods and everything else as a subsequent, was it being distinguished by this love light vibration. So that essentially you identify the one infinite creator by the love light energy or the frequency. That's the point of the law of one material. It's saying that love light is the identifying frequency of the one infinite creator, nothing else. So you have these Elohim coming forward, or these gods coming forward, claiming to be the one supreme creator god to be worshipped exclusively. So where does that take us? I'll explain shortly. So gods in the book of Genesis, the Elohim. So here's a scholar, James Sweeney, PhD, a professor of New Testament studies. And he says the term Elohim appears more than 2,500 times in the Old Testament. And if you do a software search using BibleWorks software, you'll find that, you know, that's how many uses you get. 2,600 uses, 2,248 verses, and 219 of these uses are in the book of Genesis alone. So the book of Genesis describes the Elohim. Now, what does the term Elohim mean? Because this is something that's a great controversy in biblical studies today. So there's an author, an Italian researcher. He's a interlinear Bible translator, and which means that he looks at the word-for-word translation of the Aramaic or the Hebrew or the Greek original of the Bible and gives a word-for-word translation. And that's a scholarly endeavor, and it's recognized in the scholarly community. So he was a professional translator, so he truly knows his stuff. So he says that his thesis in this book, very fascinating book that I do recommend, The Naked Bible by Mauro Bellino. It's not Biglino. So some of you that think that, no, it's not that. It's an Italian name, Bellino. The G is silent. So Mauro, he refers to the original source text of the Bible, whether you look at the Hebrew or the Greek, that those original source texts refer to the Elohim as the creator of humans, not an all-powerful God, Lord, or Yahweh. That's a distortion that was introduced by various scholars or councils that changed the original written texts and the earlier oral traditions to turn this early belief in this council of gods or the council of Elohim into a belief into an all-powerful God, Lord, or Yahweh. So the Hebrew word Elohim is plural and wrongly translated. So I'm going to try and play this, and hopefully you can watch Mauro Bellino describe his research into the Hebrew word Elohim and why it is actually a plural and wrongly translated as Lord or Yahweh in most contemporary Bibles. So let me play that now.
This is the passage where Abraham tells his story and tells, when the Elohim brought me out of my father's house. Then you see that here the verb is translated in the plural form. This is the Bible translated for scholars who know the Hebrew language. This is the guide of the verbal forms present in the Old Testament And also here it is said that the verb, it is in the plural form in the third person. So it is certain that the verb connected to the term Elohim is plural. But in the Bible translated for families, the verb is theologically translated into the singular because the term Elohim must indicate God, and so it must have the verb in the singular, even if it is plural in Hebrew. As you can see, the Bibles translated for scholars respect the letter of the Hebrew text, while the Bibles translated for families contain theological translations, that is, they must convey an idea, a different concept from what is written in the original Bible. All these Bibles are translated for the public, and therefore they have the translation of verb in the singular form. Luther's Bible, the Jerusalem Bible, the Bible of the German Bishops' Conference, the King James Bible, the Septuaginta, that is the Bible translated into Greek, the Bible published by the House of the Geneva Bible. All this derives from the fact that Elohim must be translated with the singular term God.
Mauro Bellino, he describes how the word Elohim is plural and wrongly translated as Lord or Yahweh, looking at the word-for-word translations in the Bible. And he makes the point that the interlinear text, which is the one that is used by biblical researchers, preserves the original Hebrew, which refers to Elohim, whereas the King James Version, the New Revised Version, all of the vernacular versions of the Bible used by contemporary churches all substitute the word Elohim with Lord or Yahweh. And so he's saying that this is actually a distortion. So that's what's going on there. In one of the Psalms, it describes the assembly of their Elohim. This is what is described by Mauro Bellino as an example of how the Bible actually acknowledges that there is this assembly of the Elohim. Just as I've been describing the assembly of the gods for the Sumerians, the Akkadians, that this was understood. Similarly, Abraham took with him the knowledge that the Elohim convened in an assembly to make their decisions. There's references to this in different books of the Old Testament, such as Psalm 82, and it describes this. It says, El takes his stand in the divine assembly, surrounded by the Elohim. He gives judgment. The Enuma Elish refers to the assembly of the gods, and they entered the assembly of the hall. Both the Psalm 82 and the Enuma Elish refer to an assembly which makes the decisions in terms of how humanity is to be dealt with, how the gods operate. Of course, in the Bible, they're not talking about gods, they're talking about the Elohim. So this is something that is described to some detail by these biblical scholars such as Mauro Bellino. He goes into great detail into this.
I don't want to go into the merits of all the explanations that have been worked out to try to prove that Elohim is a singular. To refute them, it is sufficient, for example, to take Psalm 82, which clearly speaks of an assembly of the Elohim.
Hopefully the point is quite clear. The Elohim have an assembly. They are the ones calling the shots, and it's not an all-powerful supreme God making these decisions for how humanity is to be dealt with if you use the source text according to Bellino. So this is something that other sources describe as well, that when it comes to humanity, the diversity of extraterrestrial genetic races or genetic experiments that have been created on Earth that are being regulated by these different extraterrestrial groups, that there's a congress or an assembly of all of the extraterrestrial races that are responsible for this. So in the book, The Only Planet of Choice, Phyllis Schlemmer, another channeled piece of literature that stood the test of time for its accuracy, it describes this, a Council of Nine. This is a kind of like a primordial group that asserts that there are 24 cedar civilizations responsible for the creation of humanity, of human life in multiple galaxies, and that they form a congress of extraterrestrial civilizations that are the ones that are seeding humanity on Earth and also human life on other planets in our galaxy or beyond. Paul Wallace, he's another biblical researcher, and he's got a series of books. I've done a recent interview with him on my Exopolitics Today channel. He's got a series of three books that begin with Escaping from Eden. And he says that the creator gods are described in many religious indigenous traditions, including the ancient Hebrews. So again, he identifies these creator gods as being described throughout many cultures, many literatures, and this is universal. And he identifies that the monotheistic god, Yahweh, was introduced around 650 BC at the first codification of the Hebrew Bible. So up until that time, the early Hebrews descended from Abraham had incorporated the Sumerian texts, the Akkadian texts that referred to the Elohim, that referred to the assembly of the gods that were the ones that had created humans and that were watching over humanity and giving guidance for how humanity should live. But around 650 BC, there appeared to be a change because there was a council, a Hebrew council, which codified the early Hebrew texts and came up with the idea of a monotheistic God, just one God, or Yahweh. Whereas the earlier text talked about the Elohim, now this council said that they reinterpreted the word Elohim from its plural meaning, referring to a council of Elohim or gods, to a singular all-powerful God, Yahweh.
I'm very happy to be in conversation with Mauro on these topics because my own research journey in the Eden series had brought me to very similar conclusions. And it was initially the issues around the word Elohim, the plural form of the word Elohim, that broke me out of my old world of narrow Christian orthodoxy to a point of view from which I can see that the Bible is not a book about God in the way I thought it was, but it is actually representative of a kaleidoscope of entities from the beginning of the Hebrew canon to the very end. Now, the word Elohim is the Bible's oldest word that gets translated as God. But as Mauro has pointed out, it is a masculine plural form that takes plural verb forms. And as I began drilling down into those questions, I realized that the problems thrown up by the plurality of that word are not just a grammatical glitch. They represent an earlier form of the story in which Elohim was understood to represent a diversity of beings. There is a body in the Hebrew canon referred to as the Sky Council, in which a number of Elohim sit in council together.
He's just talking about the Elohim as a sky council, and he describes the biblical texts that refer to the Elohim having a convention of these created beings in a council, in a sky council. and that they meet and make decisions about humanity. And he makes the point that this is actually consistent with the Bible, that this is actually part of the biblical tradition. And he's trying to point out the contradiction here that, okay, certain texts in the Bible refer to this sky council or this assembly of the Elohim that call the shots in terms of humanity and how we are to behave. But other key texts have been changed to remove the reference to this sky council of the Elohim and replace the word Elohim, which has this plural meaning, with either the word Lord or Yahweh, which refers to a singular, all-powerful God. This takes us to Abraham and the law of one and the supreme God. Now, Abraham was a descendant of Enoch. He's in the direct lineage of Enoch and a Sumerian culture bearer. He took that information from Sumer and took it into the land of Canaan, where the early Israelites emigrated. And Abraham carried with him both the law of one teachings and the Sumerians' worship of multiple gods, the Elohim. Now, this is very important because you have a couple of traditions running through Abraham here, because I mentioned earlier on that the Confederation of Planets operated in this pre-flood era, and they had promoted the law of one, which essentially is a monotheistic system of belief. And so that ran through the teachings of Enoch and went through his descendants, such as Methuselah, Noah, Abraham, and so forth. And so as a descendant of Enoch, Abraham took with him the law of one, this belief in a supreme being or a supreme force, this kind of the one infinite creator, the love light energy out of which all emerges. And he took that with him. But that was distorted at some point. So one of the Elohim, Yahweh, distorted the law of one into exclusive faith in one God above all others. In the Old Testament, Yahweh's genocidal policies contrast with the law of one. So this is where we can see very clearly that there is a great tension within the biblical texts between this kind of monotheistic idea of the one infinite creator that is based in the love light energy and this all-powerful God who is a warrior God that asserts dominance over others, over other gods and over people. One of the Elohim, Yahweh, distorted the law of one because Yahweh was one of the Elohim. He's one of the sky gods. This is the point that both Mauro Bellino and Paul Wallace make in their books, The Naked Bible, Escaping from Eden, that Yahweh was nothing more than one of the Elohim, but that the around the 6th century BC, these Hebrew scholars changed the texts to refer to Yahweh as being the one supreme God because they wanted to promote that faith system. And I think that represented Yahweh as a real life warrior God asserting himself, revealing himself to these Hebrew scholars and saying, I'm your Lord and you are to follow my teachings. So how do we know that Yahweh is nothing more than just a bloodthirsty Elohim, as opposed to the one infinite creator of all that people assume when they open up their Bibles and they read the Bible where it talks about the Lord or Yahweh? How do we know for sure that that's referring to this infinite creator disseminating love light versus this bloodthirsty Elohim that is intent on defeating other gods or other Elohim and asserting control over territories? Well, you don't have to go very far. There are many passages in the Old Testament that clearly describe Yahweh as a God, one of the Elohim, that authorized genocide. Quote, in the cities of these people that the Lord, Yahweh, your God, is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction, the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord Yahweh, your God, has commanded. I mean, clearly, this is not a one infinite creator God disseminating love light, which is the source energy for our universe. The point of the Law of One philosophy is that this love light energy is the source, that is the source energy that comes from the one infinite creator. That this Yahweh is very far from that. And there are many biblical passages mirroring this. And the points Bellino and Paul Wallace and others make, and I thoroughly agree with them, is that this Yahweh is not an all-powerful supreme God. He is one of the Elohim pretending to be the all-powerful God. And somehow he co-opted the Hebrew priesthood in the 6th century to write about him. Because clearly, someone who is this bloodthirsty, if you do not follow his dictates, you would be eliminated. Because anyone that did not follow his dictates to the letter would be eliminated. So he comes along, he tells these Hebrew patriarchs or these Hebrew scholars, this is how you're supposed to interpret this text now. I am your God, and this is what you're supposed to do.
This concludes part one. Subscribe to this channel to receive updates and notifications of future episodes. You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.